This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. this afternoon. And since this is the last Monday of the month, we are doing what we've done for the last 3 or 4 years. I'm not quite sure how long it's been official. At least 3 years we've been doing it, but I think we may have had a tryout before that. And that's of bringing in our trio of book experts from around Nevada County and the West. I'm looking at them, John Dederich, Allison Jones-Famato, and Cameron Cobden. And they're going to tell us what they think, not the best books, but certainly what their favorite books were of the last year. And then when I say, you're crazy, they'll defend what they have to say. They probably won't. They're all very good talkers, and I might just sit here in awe for the next 54 minutes. Anyway, I thought we'd start with Allison, who's now recently retired from the bookseller in Grass Valley, so you have more time to read than ever.
Yes, yesterday was my last day of work, so yes, now I finally have time to read.
And I think she already outread the three of us put together.
No doubt.
Well, people think you work in a bookstore, you read all the time, but that's certainly not the case. I go home from work and I sit down and I fall asleep as soon as I've read about a page and a half. So weekends, vacation times, that's my reading time. I'm actually going to start with a book that I thought was just great fun this year. It's called Eat, Pray, Love by Elizabeth Gilbert. She's a novelist and has written some nonfiction as well, and after just a really nasty divorce, she decided she needed to get her life together and really focus on other things, and she actually put in a book proposal that was accepted where she would spend a year working on three aspects of her personality: the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of spirituality, and then the melding of the two. She spends 4 months in Italy, eating, drinking, learning Italian, visiting museums, and just having a wonderful time, gaining 26 pounds and loving every moment of it. Then she goes to an ashram in India where she loses all those 26 pounds plus more and really focuses on her spirituality. And she spends the last 4 months in Bali where she finds out how to mix pleasure, spirituality, and finds love at the same time. It's just absolutely delightful. I haven't talked to anybody who hasn't really enjoyed this book. She just has a great voice, and it's a lot of fun. I wanted to be with her every step of the way, except at the ashram. And I felt like one of her friends had told her, I wish I wanted to do this. And that's exactly how I felt. She made it sound very appealing, but yet at the same time, I knew I really didn't want to, but I wish I did. And just was really a wonderful read, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. My favorite fiction of the year, and I tend to focus on the new books because I work in a bookstore and that's what I see, and I usually read things before they've ever even come out in advanced reading form. This book is a book called Sweetness in the Belly by Camilla Gibb. And this is fiction focused on the Middle East, actually in this case Ethiopia, North Africa, but it's about the Muslim world. And her main character is a young woman whose English parents basically abandoned her to a mosque as a child. And she is raised in this mosque, adopts the Muslim way of life, and is eventually cast out of the mosque when she reaches a certain age, lives with a family in Ethiopia, and really becomes part of that world. it jumps back and forth in time, because as an adult, she is now living in England. She is a nurse working in the public health system, and she works with Ethiopian refugees and other refugees as well. She continues to live the life of a Muslim woman in a modern English society where the refugees are becoming assimilated into the society. So it really is a clash of cultures, but it's from the opposite end. I learned a lot about Islam, and especially about women in that, because I tended to think anyway that women were subjugated to a very lower position and not necessarily treated well. And her love for the religion really comes through in this book. It's a very compelling read, and I liked it very, very much. I think it's a good read for anybody interested in that culture. People maybe who liked Kite Runner, I think, would like this book. It's not just a woman's book, even though the main characters are women.
Now, many Muslims claim that the peculiar way that women are treated, at least peculiar to us, with the heavy clothing and being kept away from men in many occasions, is actually a way of honoring and elevating them, which most Westerners find hard to believe. But it sounds like you got some of that feeling.
Absolutely. And this woman, a Western English woman, definitely feels this way. It's the refugees who are wearing the mini skirts and going out to the clubs and leaving their culture behind in many ways, where to her this was the culture that she was adopted into, and it really wove into every part of her life. It was lovely, and I highly recommend it.
What's the title again?
Sweetness in the Belly, which is a passage from the Quran that refers to, I hope I get this right, to the presence of God and Allah in your life. Another one I really enjoyed that's out in paperback now is Paul Auster's Brooklyn Follies. Auster is a Brooklynite. He's written a lot of different things about New York, and then he writes kind of less traditional fiction as well. But this is about a man dying of cancer who goes back to his home in his hometown of Brooklyn and kind of basically to die. But he puts himself back into his life there, a life he had given up a long time ago, reconnects with people, reconnects with family, and finds people in his life he didn't even know were there. And it's just a really great character story. My husband really liked it as well, too, and was actually disturbed by parts of it, where it really made him profoundly sad for the character Nathan Glass. But I liked it a lot, and I think Auster's writing is really great, and he develops deep characters, and you really get to know these people.
His novels, at least the ones I've seen, and I must admit I've never read any straight through, tend to be pretty short. So he packs a lot into a small
space.
Yes,
again, I don't have it in front of me, but I would say this is less than 300 pages. And he does pack a lot into it. Good dialogue, but again, it's really character-driven, and you totally get to know these people because he develops his characters so well. And another one I love this year, this is by a Sacramento author, actually. His name is J. Martin Troost, and it's called Getting Stoned with Savages. And Troost, this is his follow-up book to his first one, which was Sex Lives of Cannibals. These are nonfiction armchair travel memoirs, is how I would define them. And in this book, he and his wife go to the South Pacific, where the first book had also taken place. They're working as aid workers, and he is writing. And it's really about the year spent in Vanuatu and then later in Fiji, where they go as she is pregnant to have their first child. And it's just hysterically funny. I laugh aloud in his books. The title of this refers mainly to his very enthusiastic adoption of the tastes of the natives in drinking their hallucinogenic glop.
Kava.
Kava, that they define, as his wife says at one point, this looks like muddy water, and the woman next to her says, you're going to wish you were drinking muddy water. But he loves this stuff, and it's really, really funny, and just totally delightful, and just a great read for anybody who wants a break from reality. Mm-hmm. And then the last one I'm going to talk about, unless we have time later for more, but I don't want to jump in, not give anyone else time, is a book that's not brand new. It's a book my daughter's boyfriend gave me. It's To Say Nothing of the Dog by Connie Willis. The title comes from a book written in Victorian times called Three Men in a Boat to Say Nothing of the Dog by Jerome K. Jerome.
Which is the funniest book ever written.
And there. Very much so, and it's this is definitely an homage to that. Three Men in a Boat was the three men's journey on the Thames, and boating and their little adventures. And in this book, it is an homage to that, and also an homage to 1930s whodunits and science fiction. It's a time travel story, and it's quirky. It's really, really fun, and the characters are going back in time trying to find an object for the rebuilding of this great cathedral that was destroyed in World War II, and this woman wants it rebuilt exactly as it was in that night, and somebody brings back something wrong, and time is, you know, all history is set a whirl, and they have to right it all. And to do it, they have to rely on Lord Peter Wimsey's brains and prowess and Jerome K. Jerome's adventures. And it's just a delightful read. I've recommended it to lots of people. Finally got my book group to read it as well. And this book came out, I believe, about 6 years ago. And it's To Say Nothing of the Dog by Connie Willis.
Now, you said you were going to stop here, but I know you have other books on your list. And John was saying before we came on that you always steal his thunder. But I don't think any of these books are ones he was going to talk about.
No, as a matter of fact. No, well, she's read the pants off me this year, and I haven't read much in terms of new stuff. I've been going back, and I've been reading Bertolt Brecht and Hamlet and you know, stuff about Shakespeare. And I am in the midst of Nature Girl, which is the new Carl Hiaasen, which is wonderful.
Why don't we let Allison finish her list, if she can do it quickly, and now we'll know what John's going to talk about in a minute.
Well, I really only have two more. One is a book Eric talked about last year that I had not read yet, and I just have to reiterate for all those people who heard it last year or didn't hear it to know that this is just fabulous. It's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer. I read this while I was spending my summer in New York City, and this book takes place in post 9/11 New York, where this 9-year-old boy whose father has been killed finds a key that his father left behind and is determined to find the lock that fits the key. And it's his journey through New York looking for this lock, meeting lots of people. This is a kid who had a lot of problems even before his father was killed, probably has Asperger's syndrome, is extremely bright, but pretty non-functional in childlike society, but fairly comfortable in the adult world. And I loved it. I thought his writing was brilliant, and the boy is the narrator, and his voice is just fabulous.
That's what I liked about it, was the boy.
Yeah.
But I didn't care for the subplot. There is a subplot that involves I'm trying to remember the grandparents and their tangled relationship and what happened to them in Europe 40 years before.
Right, and what's happened to Grandpa.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was quirky, and I agree. I don't think it was necessary, but it was kind of a fun twist that I didn't see necessarily coming. You just think Grandma's a little crazy.
Now, is this the book that was filmed with Frodo playing the lead?
No, that was his other book.
That's his other book. And what's
Everything
that?
Is Illuminated.
Everything
was his
Illuminated,
first book.
Mm-hmm. Which and is a wonderful film.
Really, I've heard some people say it's a better book than this, but I haven't read it.
I think the other way around. I think this is a better book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I like them both, though. I think
did
he's
you see
a
the film?
I did not see the
it's
film.
It's worth seeing.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
I think he's a good writer. And I'm anxious to see what comes next from him.
And what interests me is, I guess, he writes more or less the way Hedwig Villa-Lobos composed that with the radio on full blast and constantly being interrupted or riding on the subway, or he's one of those people who seems to flourish in confusion and complexity, I guess. And he seems to somehow find a way to concentrate with all those things rushing in around him.
Yeah.
So I've heard.
I love him. I can't wait to read more from him. He just has the two books out, and hopefully more's to come soon. And my last book is a children's book, because that was my specialty at the bookseller, and it's The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane. It's written by Kate DiCamillo, and she has won the Newbery Award twice previously for The Tale of Despero and Because of Winn-Dixie. This is her best book. I would be shocked if she doesn't win the Newbery this year. I think most other booksellers will, too. Everyone I've talked to says, well, what else is there that's as this good? And it's the story of a young girl, Abigail Tulane, who has this large white china rabbit whose name is Edward. And Edward is, as all love toys really are, alive, yet she doesn't know it. But he's really not very nice. He's very cold-hearted and very vain. And he's lost on a boating trip and falls into the water. And it's his tale of getting back home. It's his chance for redemption, to become a better rabbit, so to speak. And it's he gets pretty beaten up and battered, but it's the story of the power of love to redeem us. And she had an imaginary child friend, a rabbit, that toy rabbit she met on a vacation as her parents were being divorced, and she was with Dad and the new girlfriend in a very rainy Jersey Shore vacation, and found this rabbit in the attic and played with it all week long. And when it was time to leave, Dad says, "We don't have room for that," and left it there. And this was her real friend, and she felt that loss very profoundly. So this is a tribute to this childhood friend of hers, and to the power children's imaginations have to create friends when they really need them.
When are the Newberries announced?
Newberries are usually announced middle of January, and it's the Newbery, the Caldecott, and various other awards, which are awarded by the American Library Association.
Okay, John, Shakespeare, Brecht, Dylan Thomas.
Beckett. And Carl Hiaasen. How's that for a mix? Well, I'll talk about Hiaasen. It's a new book. It's still in hardback. Nature Girl. All of his books have two-word puns. They're all puns. They're all two words. They're wonderful. I'm sure you've read Carl Hiaasen. Carl Hiaasen is a wonderful writer. He's very funny and very political. It's all about the destruction of Florida in the name of greed and the American way of life. It's just, and he's a satirist of the highest degree. And this one is no different. I'm not done with it. I'm about halfway into it. But it's just fun. If you want to read something that's fun, entertaining, somewhat enlightening about Florida habitat and the kind of ghoulish things that go on down there, not just in politics, but also out in the wild.
And he takes on telemarketers.
Yeah,
that's only Hiaasen in Canada.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a lot of fun. So I'm doing that.
Now, I found that I've enjoyed every one of his books that I've read, and I think I've read all of them. The characters, the details of the plot, the ridiculous ways they bounce off one another are just delightful. But I've been a little disappointed in the last two or three I've read that he seems to fall back on the ex-governor who's living
the skink.
Living in the swamp as sort of a crutch when he can't think of any other way to end the story. Does he come into this one?
Well, you know, Euripides used deus ex machina, so you can't fault Carl Hiaasen too badly.
No.
If he comes into it, he hasn't come into it yet, because, like I said, I'm only halfway through, and they're in the Everglades, so we'll have to wait and see.
So he probably will.
He probably will, with his, you know, shower cap on and his glass eye. Wonderful character. What else? Well, I'm currently sort of diving into the world of Samuel Beckett, who is my favorite playwright, and I'll be acting the role of Ham in Endgame at the Center for the Arts that opens in April. Michael Bernowski is directing. It should be a lot of fun. So I have a massive line burden in this play, so I have to learn. I'm starting now. So that's been kind of fun and entertaining. I was very successful say, in all humility, interning on some of my students at Colfax High School under Simon Beckett, and they of their own volition staged and presented 6 Beckett one acts and little short things, and one play that I wrote called Back It, which is sort of an homage, as it were. So I'm happy to just spread the gospel of Samuel Beckett, who I think is just the greatest writer of the 20th century. So I go ahead.
Do you like his novels as well as his plays?
Not as much as the plays. Not as much as the plays. I've read all the novels. I've read everything, and I like Malloy. I think is my favorite one. Some of them are they're not unreadable, but a couple of them get close.
Yeah, and I find I've had trouble getting into them, but it could be because of the trilogy and that little evergreen paperback. Mm-hmm. Is the type is too small, and it just isn't a comfortable book to read. And mm-hmm. I've always wondered, would I enjoy them more if I read them in a better edition?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't help you there because that's the edition that I have too. So I don't know, but I love Malloy. I think Malloy is hilarious and wonderful, wonderful stuff. And I've actually performed sections of Malloy at various venues in the past. I'd like to read something from Endgame if I could. This is a speech from Endgame. You're probably familiar with it out there, listener. It's the trash can play. It's the play where there are two people in trash cans who are ostensibly, possibly, although nothing is certain in this play, but they're probably Ham's parents. And Clove, who pushes Ham around in his chair, is quite possibly, but nothing is certain, Ham's adopted son. But this speech is from Nag, who is, as I said, possibly Ham's father, and he is in a trash can, what in England you'd call an ash can. And he wants to tell this story to his wife, Nell, who's in the adjacent ash can. The context indicates that he tells this story frequently. And he says, "Let me tell it again. An Englishman, needing a pair of striped trousers in a hurry for the New Year festivities, goes to his tailor, who takes his measurements. 'That's the lot. Come back in 4 days. I'll have it ready.' 'Good. 4 days later. 'So sorry, come back in a week. I've made a mess of the seat.' 'Good, that's all right. A neat seat can be very ticklish.' A week later. 'Frightfully sorry, come back in 10 days. I've made a hash of the crotch.' 'Good, can't be helped. A snug crotch is always a teaser.' 10 days later. 'Dreadfully sorry, come back in a fortnight. I've made a balls of the fly.' 'Good, at a pinch, a smart fly is a stiff proposition.' I never told it worse. I tell this story worse and worse. Well, to make it short, the bluebells are blowing, and he bollockses the buttonholes. 'God damn you to hell, sir. No, it's indecent. There are limits. And 6 days, do you hear me? 6 days. God made the world. Yes, sir. No less, sir. The world. And you are not bloody well capable of making me a pair of trousers in 3 months.' 'But, my dear sir,' says the tailor, 'my dear sir, look at the world, and look at my trousers.'" Which I think is wonderful and fun.
Did he first write that in French?
Yes, this is the period when he was writing in French, yeah.
I can't imagine it having quite the same punch in French. But
well, one wonders, and I haven't looked at this in French. I looked at Godot when I directed Godot now over 20 years ago. I read that in French, because that was originally written in French, En attendant Godot. And I haven't read this one, but I'll have to get a French copy and look at it and see how idiomatic that would be translated, because obviously there's such... things that are just true to particular culture makes it very hard to translate.
And the particular wordplay.
Sure. Which is just phenomenally fun. That's what I love about him. And I think Beckett's hilarious. And some people think it's gloomy and doomy, but not me. He just makes me laugh. And then I'm directing Brecht. I'm directing Mother, Courage, and Her Children at Colfax High School, and that'll be on the end of January. So I sort of dove into the Brecht thing, which is I've never appeared in a Brecht play, nor have I ever directed a Brecht play before. And it's somewhat alarming. It's very difficult because he's a very demanding playwright. It's very the style that you want to try to get, which he calls epic theater, and the acting technique, which is unfortunately translated as alienation, but it isn't really that. It's really just about always reminding the audience that this is a play. He doesn't want you to forget that this is, you know, he wants to get rid of that whole concept of the suspension of disbelief. He wants you to never forget that you're in a theater. In fact, Brecht proposed that the house light should be left on and people should be allowed to smoke. so that they can intellectually appreciate it and not get caught up in the emotions of the piece. Indeed, in Mother Courage, which is a phenomenally, it's a wonderful play. It's an extraordinary play. I have a new translation by David Hare, which is quite good. It's set during the 30 Years' War, which is the early 17th century when Catholics and Protestants are slaughtering each other by the thousands. And indeed, at the end of the 30 Years' War, half the population of the German-speaking provinces were reduced by 50%. That's how terrible it was. So he set it there, but it's really a parable for all war at all times. And I think it's perfectly appropriate for right now. And it would be, unfortunately, it's appropriate any time.
Now, some of his plays, the whatever you want to call it, alienation effect is more blatant than in this. Things like the Caucasian Chalk Circle or The Good Woman of Sichuan, Good Person of Sichuan. And you can easily pretend that this is a parable he's telling you, that he's trying to convince you to make a political point and not get you involved in the characters. But in this case, you get Mother Courage. He can't sustain that. She becomes such a powerful, overwhelming person that you can't believe she's just representing something.
Well, and you can't help but be moved by the deaths of all of her children. That's just... And Brecht was unhappy with that. In fact, after the premiere, when people were raving about the presence of Mother Courage and her depth as a character and how profoundly moved they were by the performance, he rewrote it. He tried to write that down. He tried to tone that down. He tried to make her less sympathetic and make her less the imposing figure in the gym. But he failed.
Because she is a war profiteer, among other things.
Yeah. She's, Halliburton on two legs. And he failed. She is still compelling. It is still moving. He tries to undercut it with music. There's music in all of his plays, and some will step out of a grisly situation all of a sudden start and tell the audience, I'm going to sing now, and off we go. So we have that effect as well. But I think my students are enjoying it. I think they're going to do a very good job, but it's a challenging piece.
I would think this would be harder for high school kids than some of the other ones mentioned.
I think so. And of course, I didn't find that out until I was well into my rehearsal period, but that's sort of how it goes. That's what it's like. A rehearsal process is when you learn the play. Not that, I know this play, now I'm going to do this. No, an honest director knows that it's a process of discovery and exploration. Let's see, what else?
Hamlet you were talking about.
Yes, Hamlet. Well, I always like to look at Hamlet again. It's the play I've seen more than the other, and it's the... it's actually, some people claim it's the play that's been most performed in the history of the human race, more than any other play. It's certainly Shakespeare's most performed play.
More than The Mousetrap?
More than The Mousetrap. Well, all those consecutive years, maybe not. But then, I don't know if The Mousetrap has been translated into, 75 languages and performed all over the world. The Germans are very fond of Shakespeare, as are the Russians as well, and the Italians. The French like their own works. They're French, so I just marvel in this play, and I've had a love-hate relationship with it. I was fortunate enough to be able to play Hamlet in college when I was at UC Santa Barbara. That was fun, and I also directed the play several years ago at Foothill Theater Company, right up the street here. And every time I look at it or approach it, I get new things from it. I've seen almost all the film versions, including a wacky deconstructed Swedish one, which is just bizarre, and the famous Russian one from 1963 with, I forget, famous Soviet actor. But
don't know who he's talking about. Soviet actors are beyond my purview.
Yeah, do you know who I'm talking about?
I'm familiar with the production. I've heard it discussed.
Oh, it's profound. It's really good. It's really, really, really good. But I don't remember his name. So every time I look at it, as I said, I get something new from it. What I've really developed more and more over the years is sympathy for Claudius. And someday in my life, before I get too much grayer, it's a role I would love to play. I think it's the best role and the best character in the play. Certainly what's compelling about Hamlet as a piece of theater is the character of Hamlet. He's complex. He's up and down all over the map. Is he a spoiled brat? Is he too introspective? What is his problem? And people have argued about that for 400 years, and they'll continue to argue about it forever. But I find Claudius to be really compelling. He's an able ruler. He has a grasp of the situation. He's ruthless. He's a murderer. He's not a nice man. Nonetheless, he's a man with a conscience. He's a man who feels deeply that he has sinned. is aware that he has damned himself, and yet proceeds anyway. And there's something that's sort of like, I don't know if you could call it noble about him, but there certainly is something persistent about him that I find really admirable.
Persistent, whereas you'd say in Macbeth's case it's desperation, but in Claudius's it's a little more determination?
Very much so. And another contrast between those two characters is Macbeth has no conscience. He's completely submerged his conscience. There's nothing.
As he says, I'm so stupid. I don't completely agree with you on that, but that's a matter for another time.
Well, it's what Lady Macbeth, who's the original, I mean, he begins with a conscience, and, you know, Macbeth is worried, 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 and Lady Macbeth is, don't worry about it, a little water clears us of this deed, and yet it's her conscience that tortures her and drives her mad. And he is just, when she dies, he says she would have died hereafter. He's untouched. He's beyond being touched.
Has anyone here read Updike's Gertrude and Claudius, or Claudius and Gertrude?
Mm-hmm. No, I haven't. I should do that.
I did a few years ago. That's the
good?
Cats, right? Oh, no, that, no. Yes, but it's his...
I haven't read it, but it is yeah. the story told from their point of view. And is it something the rest of us should read?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I read it several years ago, and I actually worked on John's production of Hamlet we did it. And that's my only real experience with Hamlet other than seeing a few films and all. And yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of, you know, like taking two characters who are important to the story but aren't the main focus. I prefer Stoppard's look at
Rosencrantz
it from Rosencrantz
and
Guildenstern are dead.
Which is wonderful.
To the Updike.
Yeah, does the Updike novel, does it make Claudius more sympathetic?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with John. He's a really interesting, complex character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's how kings came to power in those times for, you know, up until really just, and well, in some places still, you know. you know, it's a violent occupation, and the hazards are high, so it's a... It was kind of part of life, and certainly in Shakespeare's time, that was the reality.
Absolutely, very much the reality. So. And it's interesting to note that, you know, he wrote, it premiered in 1600. So 1599, 1600, he was writing Hamlet. And, of course, the dominant political concern of the day was who is going to succeed Elizabeth. She's aging. She's in quite failing health at this point. She eventually dies 3 years later. She dies in 1603. So this one of the overlooked by more contemporary critics is the issue of succession in the play Hamlet. Hamlet's the rightful king. You know, as he says at one point, Claudius has popped in between the election and my hopes. And when he jumps into the grave to confront Laertes, he says, it is I, Hamlet the Dane, meaning I am the rightful king, openly threatening Claudius, etc. So... if you're looking at Shakespeare through the lens of contemporary events and the lens of what's happening politically in his world, then you can see that this is a sort of not very subtle message about, you know, let's get a successor to the queen and let's make sure that this is a strong person who can rule, you know, Britain.
Because in her case, she had no designated successor.
That's right. She was the Virgin Queen, at least ostensibly, and certainly there was no heir presumptive of any kind, so they had to go all the way up to get the son of the woman that she had killed, James I, son of Mary Queen of Scots, who was James VI at Scotland, and then you have kingdoms uniting. So there's very much that kind of political intrigue in Hamlet that I think is, a lot of it can be rooted back to the politics of the day. And since that, the book that we were talking about, the last time,
the Asquith book?
Yes, the Asquith book. About
Shadow Play?
Shadow Play, about the, which takes as its thesis that Shakespeare is a Catholic and is a closeted Catholic, and he's working, there's a lot of subtle messages in his plays in which he's sort of appealing to the conscience of non-Catholics to lighten up on the Catholic persecution, which is so heavy and severe at this point. And I don't agree. I think she stretches some of her arguments, but some of them are really... It's quite interesting to look at the play or any other play through the lens of a particular point of view and just see how well that sticks. And, of course, you can do that from multiple perspectives. And the greater the work is, the more complex it is, and the more ways in which you can look at it, it seems to me.
This is Booktown on KBMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. This is our end-of-the-year review of what our longtime panel, I guess it is, of John Dederich, Allison Jones Pomato, and Cameron Cobden have liked in the past year. How about you, Cameron?
Well, the book that I'm most excited about having read this past year is a book that I really can't discuss in any detail. Half Broken Things by Morag Joss is something you'll find over in crime fiction, where it does not necessarily belong. It is a fantastic novel in which the author constructs this very intimate architecture of an unavoidable disaster in a manner that draws you right in to these characters and the predicament that they create, all the while letting you know that this can only end in tears. So it's a really very, very interesting book. But saying anything more about it would give way too much away. The other...
Can you tell us where it takes place? Or
I can tell you that it takes place in England, and that's all I'm going to say.
You can't give us a year?
No.
Okay. The month? The time of day?
The holidays are involved at one point.
See, Eric's intrigued. I think everyone should be intrigued. Mm-hmm.
But it is a really very interesting book that I highly recommend. Another one that I recommend strongly is A Thread of Grace by Mary Doria Russell. And I know a lot of people have already read this book. I encourage everyone else to do it too. It's a book that deals with the Holocaust and specifically efforts to resist the Germans and protect Jewish refugees and Jewish nationals in Italy from 1943 to 1945. It's a work of fiction, but it relies very heavily on factual detail. And it's a book that she struggled very hard with as an author in order to construct something that she felt would actually honor, as she called it, the crazy, courageous, balls-to-the-wall risks that were taken by Italians to protect people who they did not necessarily have any history of really protecting and defending. And she pointed out that it's her belief that in this day and age, it's very important to remember the risks and the chances that were taken at that time and to really examine the decisions that were made, because she believes, and I think she's probably correct, that most of us would not do that. That most people would not make the sorts of decisions to save their friends, their neighbors, and complete strangers at great risk to their own lives, history, and culture. And it is so beautifully and painfully done. One of the critics was very angry with her and wrote her a letter saying that he felt that she had made mistakes in the book because he could not safely become emotionally invested with any of the characters because he just didn't know if they were going to be okay. And she said, well, it's the Holocaust. Duh. You don't get to feel good about the Holocaust.
Really.
But it is such a beautifully rendered book, and it is painful and challenging, but really a very rewarding book.
Now, I know her name, but I've never read anything else of hers.
Other books include The Sparrow.
And Children of Men, which The Sparrow is a sequel to. Mm-hmm. And I just saw today, or yesterday, I think, the first ad for the film coming out of Children of Men, and a review today that was, stellar, so it's supposed to be a...
And she's a very fine, very disciplined author.
And her other books are futuristic, so yes. This is her...
She's usually a sci-fi kind of an author, but in this book she really just delves into Italy in 1943 to 1945 and gives you some wonderful characters. And in addition to that, I've read Latro in the Mist, which is a rebinding of two books by Gene Wolfe, Soldier in the Mist and Soldier of Arity.
Oh, Soldier in the Mist is a great book. That is a great book.
The predicament of the main character and the motif of the novel is that he is a foreign mercenary in the Persian Wars in Greece, ancient Greece. He is fighting on the side of the Persians when he is injured terribly, and this results in a head injury which leaves him unable to remember anything after 24 hours. So he starts a journal to document what has happened during the day so that he can read it the next day and know how to proceed. Of course, this becomes a long volume that he can only refer to in bits and pieces later on. And each of his entries sort of refers back to the extent that he can, and sometimes doesn't refer back at all. It just sort of documents what he can get down during that day. And he's almost a new person each day. But he also has the power to see things that other people around him cannot see or experience. He has the ability to experience divinity almost as a natural function. He doesn't realize that this is something unusual or different, and he's not ever terribly surprised by the deities that he encounters. But they sort of guide him along the way in a hero's quest that is unlike most of the others that we have an opportunity to read.
Now, Gene Wolfe's books are mostly set in classical times,
yes.
Greek and Roman times, but he himself is categorized as a science fiction writer.
Strangely enough, he is, and there's very little science fiction to it. A lot of science fiction owes a great deal to ancient texts and mythological retellings of nature, but I would not categorize Latro and the Mist as a science fiction text, or even really as a fantasy. I think it's an interesting
character
study.
Some people prefer the term speculative fiction to science fiction, and I would think this might fall in that.
I don't think there's anything speculative about a first-person narrative written by a character who's very entrenched in his predicament. So I wouldn't call it very much speculative fiction. He really is committed to anchoring this character in a way that throws the reader into chaos and calls it really calls upon the reader to try to fight through Latro's problems and remember the things that have been written before. So I really enjoyed that book. It's very challenging, however. It is not an easy book to read.
Are you saying there's a sequel, or you said that?
It's two books together. They're Soldier in the Mist.
Right, which is the one I've read.
And Soldier of Arete, which is the next. It continues his story and brings it to a sort of a climax at the Greek Olympiad.
Mm-hmm. Great, I'll have to get that one.
And there's apparently a third one that I have not read. But those two were written almost 20 years ago,
yes.
I believe. And there's a recent third book in the series.
Hmm.
And one of the books, I'm actually currently in the middle of the 25th anniversary edition of Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children. I love magic realism, and I love Rushdie. His sense of whimsy mixed with political reality is very compelling to me, and something that I've appreciated in other authors such as Mark Halperin. And I know that you've had some trouble with Halperin.
I actually had some trouble with Rushdie in that I started mm-hmm. reading it 25 years ago and loved it, but mm-hmm. for some reason didn't finish it. And I can't quite figure it out, because usually a book that I like that much keeps me going. I think I must have just been interrupted by something that I couldn't postpone, and by the time it was over, I figured I should start all over.
Well, they've just reissued it, so perhaps it's telling you something. It's time to return to Rushdie.
Who's an author that I really don't like?
Okay, why
well,
not?
Well, you and several million other people.
Yeah,
and it has nothing to do with his politics, which I do like, and has nothing to do. I just find that he overwrites. I like Midnight's Children. I think that's a good book, but I think it's all downhill after that. That's his breakthrough novel,
mm-hmm.
and the one that I couldn't even finish was the one that's sort of a take on the Orpheus myth. Did you read this one, Cam? This is I forget the title, but it's. It's Orpheus and Eurydice, and she's a rock singer.
Yeah, that's The Ground Beneath Her Feet.
Yeah, Ground Beneath
yeah,
Her Feet.
That's the one that, from having read reviews, I just didn't want to go anywhere close to.
Well, I think that's a wise choice, Eric. Because I found it just to be horribly pretentious and overwritten, and just sort of like continually playing with you in a way that I found almost offensive, as in, look at me, I'm so clever. I can do this with language, aren't I cool? And I just had that sort of sense of the tone of the book, which is why... I didn't finish it.
I think he maybe needs to be anchored in South Asia to really get away from that, because I think Midnight Children, and the other one that really appeals to me, although I haven't read it, is The Moor's Last Sigh.
The Moor's Last Sigh is a lovely book, and Haroon and the Sea of Stories is a wonderful book.
That didn't...
Wasn't that young adult fiction?
Yeah.
That is young adult fiction. Mm.
And that and one, there's I couldn't finish because I didn't like it.
There's been a production, a stage production. Berklee Repertory Theater
That's
did
right.
a stage production of Haroon and the Sea of Stories that was absolutely wonderful. Really, really great. Funny for everybody.
Well, I've heard this enough times that I'm going to give it another try, but I read 40, 50 pages and decided I'd do something more beneficial.
The thing that I like about Rushdie and Helprin when they're writing about politics and place and their sense of magic in those places is the portrait that they construct of India or New York is so very palpable. There's something about it where you really get to experience how the beauty works with the parts that are ugly, the parts that don't work, the way that it all interconnects, and the way that they use language to express their affection for their cities is very compelling.
Cameron's bringing up Mark Helprin because I brought in a bunch of books that I had liked for this year, which I may or may not get to, but my big disappointment for this year was Helprin's Winter's Tale, which I've been carrying around with me almost literally for the 25 years since it came out. And originally in the small, I guess I have trouble with certain editions of books, but the small mass market paperback I could never get into. Finally, a really nice big trade paperback with some very nice illustrations came out. I picked it up and jumped into it, and I could tell from the very beginning that it could go either way, that I could get caught up because he is so playful in his language and his situations. There's obviously no literal truth to them, although there's so many details that are as specific as they possibly can be. It was one set of set pieces after another, and I found them quite interesting, but I got to a certain one when they're going up the river in the winter that I suddenly thought, how much of this do I want to read? And I stopped. And I'm on the
well, you
verge
can't
now. I
quit
might start
just going up the river. Of course, that's a struggle.
Of course. We'll see, because it's one of those books also that I think was written at a certain time and with a certain sensibility that is getting somewhat dated. And I don't know if it's going to make it for me or not. But I'm definitely, in this case, going to try it again. Both Midnight's Children and Winter's Tale, I will finish whether
is
I'm having trouble along the way.
Is there any relation between Winter's Tale and Shakespeare's play? Of
not that...
There is.
Oh.
Ah.
Uh-huh. See, you need to keep reading.
I need to keep going.
There is indeed. It is a fantasy that deals with romance, with people who fall, with time travel and resurrection, with lost characters being found again. It's a beautifully done book.
Okay,
but you really have to get to the end of it before you can discover that.
Okay, so I think I need to take some more long train trips. That's where I was enjoying it, going to and from San Francisco. Once I got back here, I couldn't pick it up with quite the same enthusiasm I had before. I guess since we've got about 8 minutes left, I'll jump. Oh, yeah, and at the very end, we're going to give John a chance to do a seasonal reading. But I'll just mention a couple of books that really appealed to me this year. Normally, most of the books that do something to me are what we would broadly call nonfiction. I read some fiction, but not a whole lot. This year, I found I read it much, much more than usual, and most of them are the books that really got me were fiction. However, there are three new books. One is actually a year or two old, but it got to me on crucial moments in world history that very much appealed to me. The first is Karen Armstrong's The Great Transformation, The Beginning of Our Religious Traditions, which I think is a flawed work. It doesn't succeed as well as she might have been able to, but she's the first person who's actually tried to carry through an enterprise that the German philosopher Karl Jaspers proposed maybe 40 or 50 years ago. He's the one who gave the name the Axial Age to the period from, the 9th to the 2nd century B.C., when most of the great philosophies from around the world came into being, from Taoism and Confucianism in China to the real establishment of Hinduism and Buddhism and some of the other sects like Jainism in India, Zoroastrianism, and then the Greek philosophers and the Hebrew prophets. And tying all this all together is an almost impossible task, and I think she's stumbled in a couple of places. But I'm just so glad that somebody has finally made the beginning, has sort of carried up on Jasper's challenge to do this. And I'm sure that in the future it'll get clearer and clearer, and how these particular traditions developed, and in some cases how they even interacted, will be one of the big scholarly enterprises of the next couple of dozen years. And then the other great axial historical period was 1963 and 64 and 65, when Bob Dylan, Richard and Mimi Farina, and Joan Baez mm-hmm. were interacting, almost as momentous an event. And David Hajdu wrote about this a couple of years ago in Positively Fourth Street, which is a completely uncompromising, unsentimentalized look at these four people, and completely fascinating, and gives you just a strong feeling of how they developed and what influence they had on the musicians, but on the entire culture around them. And he doesn't do much analysis. It's almost straight narrative, but because of that, it's perhaps stronger. And it's such a contrast in a way to Dylan's own Chronicles from last year, which is a fascinating book, but we were talking about this earlier, I think completely unreliable, as so much of what Dylan has to say is. And this, as far as I know, is completely reliable, and it'll get you a long way. And then I read Rory Stewart's The Places in Between, which Allison says they just can't keep in at the bookseller. It's a story of his walk from, I'm trying to remember, was it Herat, to Kabul in Afghanistan a couple of years ago. He set out as one man wanting to walk this distance because he'd already been walking through Iran and parts of India and Nepal, and these were the places in between he hadn't been able to go to. It was just after the fall of the Taliban, and everybody warned him not to. They were probably right, but he did it anyway, and it's a fascinating description of the people he encountered in those several months.
Has anybody else here read or seen a production of Tony Kushner's Homebody Kabul?
No, not me.
No. My son saw the production in the Lesser New York.
And that's another one that I would strongly recommend.
And then when we jump to fiction, I don't have much time for this. I would say that when Naguib Mahfouz died a couple of months ago, I had considered him probably one of the, first I was saying two, and then I would say three greatest living novelists. The other, in my mind, were Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Haruki Murakami. And I was kind of puzzled by this because the novel, if you want to call it that, is becoming more and more a women's sphere. And I think in a few years, most of the great novelists will be women. But the only women I could have put on that list, I think, would have been Doris Lessing and maybe Toni Morrison. And
Margaret Atwood?
No, I wouldn't put Margaret Atwood anywhere close.
Sacrilege.
But anyway, I've been reading a bunch of Mahfouz, some of his shorter novels, since he died. And what is so fascinating about him, he's very much, in some ways, like a very modern Balzac, in that he'll write about a few characters from a particular stratum of society, and you'll get to know everything there is about who they are, who they interact with, how they live, what they do, in very deftly, briefly told episodes. He wrote most of his books as serials in newspapers, so the chapters are all very short, and he has to get everything that is significant in that time frame into that chapter. So usually they're episodic, and quite often each chapter, five or six pages, will be what happens, and then the next chapter will be possibly another day or possibly another generation. He wrote two things called the Harafish and Arabian Nights and Days, which span dozens of generations in 200 or 300 pages. But he also writes these very short ones. The one I'm reading right now is Adrift on the Nile, about a Egyptian civil servant who's a drug addict and can't quite face reality, and how his life is going. I'm only about 30 pages into it, but it's only 160. I'll probably finish in a couple of days. And I don't get to talk about any of the rest of the books I like because John wants to get us back in the spirit of the season.
Well, I want to get us back in the spirit of good language. And you know, one of the reasons that I love Hamlet is I love the language of Shakespeare. And love that. But he's not the only great writer. And I just happened to pick up this morning, just quite by serendipity, A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas. Was out on the coffee table at home. Jordy had been reading it. And I just looked at it again, and I just remembered just how glorious the language was. I'll just read the opening business here because I just think it's so wonderful. One Christmas was so much like another. In those years around the sea town corner now and out of all sound, except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and six nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases roll down toward the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street, and they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea, and out come Mrs. Prothero and the firemen.
This has been Booktown on KVMR FM, Nevada City. Stay tuned for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party.